countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Now on RTE Radio 1, it's time for Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, how best to tackle world hunger? Reaction from MEPs on the reform of the Common Agricultural Policy. Making the move to organic farming with the first in a series of reports. And coping with the lockdown, farmer and writer John Connell has some thoughts.
Text 51551. Email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
Six.
But first, we're in a new lockdown, and that means, for the most part, that we can't travel outside a 5k radius of where we live. Well, this morning, I haven't had to travel too far. In fact, I've travelled about 500 metres from where I live to find a farmer. And would you believe it, I was born and bred in Castleknock, but I've never been on this farm. And in fact, it's the last remaining farm inside the M50. We're here on the Guinness Farm, which is nestled between the M50 and the Phoenix Park. And I'm here with the farm manager, Peter Taff. Well, Peter, as they say, nearest the chapel last to mass. I've been passing this place for 4 decades and I've never been inside the gates, but I walk in and suddenly I'm in the countryside.
Jamie, you're not the only one. I suppose I'm involved in the rugby club in Coomine, and the guys that live up the road here couldn't believe there was a farm here. It's just well hidden, I suppose, with the trees and that, but we kind of take it for granted every day, and some people see tractors going in and out and they wonder what's going on, but it is a full working farm.
Now, if I look into the distance, and people might be able to hear in the distance, that's the din of the M50, and over behind me as I swing around, we can see the clock tower in Farmley, and right around then, the other side is, of course, Castleknock College. So this is where you're actually situated. Will you tell me a little bit more about the history of the farm here, Peter?
Yeah, the history of the farm. The farm has been probably in the Guinness family for, it's probably 7 generations now. At the present moment we're standing, we have 45 acres of our working farm, and then we have about 25 acres, around 25 acres, outside the estate. And we rent other bits and pieces of Castleknock College and Mansackville Common, 20 acres each, 40 acres there.
Well, I always remember the milk lorry coming in here, but that's no longer the case now, because it was a dairy farm up until last year.
Yeah, up to last year. We had the cows up to last year, and the cows were here for probably about 70 years or so, making cows, even when they were using the old churns. But it was getting harder and harder to farm, and it was harder to probably work. We needed big numbers, and that's the way it's gone, Damien. You see it yourself. A lot of lads with family farms now, they've got 100 cows, 150 cows, and we would have to invest an awful lot of money as well. So it was better the way it worked out for everybody, you know, and for the family themselves, you know.
We might go into the field here. We have an audience. Yeah, we have the cattle. the dairy herd is gone, but
But these are foliars now. We kept these from the dairy herd last year, and they're about 20 months old. So hopefully next summer. They are Frisians, and they would be our Halstein cows, but they're actually quite good nick for Frisians, you know. So, that was a rusty gate, isn't it?
Right. So you've a mix of breeds here.
Yeah, there's Angus, and we had Whiteheads as well. There's a couple of Angus. There's mostly white Frisians in this, Boston Frisians in this, and there's Angus as well. We keep a few Angus sucklers here at the present moment. Sucklers to me here, they're grand all right and they look well, but you seem to always seem to see the backside of a calf, a suckler cow. He never seems to come towards you, you know, seems to be running away from you. So these are all buckled rare, and as you can see yourself, they come to you and they're easy handled and they follow your bag. So they work very well for us here, you know.
Yeah. What about the land here? Is it good?
It's lovely land. It's really good land. It's really dry land. It's lovely soil. You're on the Liffey Valley here, and it's very rich and gravelly type of soil, but it's lovely ground. In the springtime here, we'd have loads of grass. It's very early ground. It's sheltered as well, which helps it, you know. Mm. So it comes very early, but it doesn't like dry weather. And you can see yourself, there's big beech trees here, and doesn't like dry weather at all, which is, listen, cattle even thrived last year in the dry weather. I thought they even done well.
And if we ever need a reminder that there's a farm here, I got it a couple of weeks ago when I was going for a little run in the Phoenix Park, and I got the lovely waft of slurry.
Yeah.
How does that go down with the neighbours here in Castleknock?
Oh, I get a few texts now and again. A couple of lads text me, you know, and that, you know, but I just tell them to get the washing in, you know, very quick. You know. But look, we're doing it for years here, so people who move into the area kind of have to accept it, you know, doing it, you know. It goes back to the same thing when we had the cows, we had a lot of slurry, and it was a very dense smell. And when you're up around the village in Castleknock, you probably would smell it. But in general, we haven't got that much slurry now. We're with the dry stock and that, you know, the cows.
So how long more will you get a lot of grass around? How long more will you have the cattle out before you'll put them in for the winter?
I was looking at dates around the 20th of next month, November, and I'll hopefully get cattle in. Like, they seem happy enough there. They're content, you know. This is lovely weather for cattle. They're in good condition, you know, and it's good shelter here as well. They have a nice bit of picking there as well. Mm. So around the 20th, we'll get cattle in, right, and we'll probably put in a bit.
There hasn't been a shortage of grass this year, I'm told by farmers.
Fantastic year for grass. And I tell you, those couple of years there, it was scarce enough. But in general, it has been a very good back end of the year. So lads have gotten silage in that, you know.
Well, as I said, we're facing into 6 weeks now of a lockdown and confined to our local area. And this is just an example of what you can actually find on your own doorstep if you look. Because, as I said, this is my first time on this farm, having grown up here only a couple of miles away and living literally 500 metres away from you here. It's proof that there's always something to find. Very local.
It's surprising, even around North Dublin there is still a lot of pockets of dairy farms, and there's a friend of mine getting into cows in North Dublin, which I thought we were all getting out in Dublin. I think there's only 14 farmers left in Dublin, dairy farmers.
So this is definitely the only farm inside the M50.
Working farm. And right, people say, is it a working farm? It is a working farm. It's not a hobby farm. We have to make things...
Make money out of it too
as well, and that, you know.
Well, Peter, it's great to meet you. And we're surrounded here by the cattle. They're very inquisitive, these Castleknock cattle. And we wish you all the very best in the future. And thanks very much, Peter. And that was Peter Taft, the farm manager there at the Guinness Farm in Castleknock in Dublin 15, just proving that within 5k of where you live, there is probably somewhere to explore for the very first time. Well, look, it is really a tough time for all of us and everybody around the country in so many ways. But another more pressing threat to hundreds of millions of people across the world is, of course, hunger. And earlier this month, Concern and partners issued a new report, the 15th Global Hunger Index, highlighting that, for example, there are alarming levels of hunger in 11 countries that they analysed, and serious levels in another 40 countries, particularly in Africa. Now, Dr. Robin Alders contributed to the report, and she joins me now from her home in New South Wales in Australia. Dr. Alders, good morning, good evening to you. I know you're a vet, you're a consultant with the Chatham House think tank, and you're also a sheep farmer there in Australia. But first, let's establish your Irish connections.
Thanks. Hello to you, Ben, and thanks very much for Concern for giving me the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners. Yes, on my mum's side, we still have family in County Monaghan. They're probably new arrivals by Irish standards. They've been on the same dairy farm for about 600 years.
Okay, so you have that established farming link with the Emerald Isle. Now, I just want to go to this report. It's quite sobering. And it's an issue we all know going back many years, and many of us will remember, obviously, Ethiopia in 1984, and ever since then it's been very much on our radar, especially for my generation. In your report, you consider the Global Hunger Index. What does it tell us about hunger globally?
Well, we are sadly, over the last 4 to 5 years, seeing increases in the absolute number of people who are facing hunger. Of course, globally, we also have problems with what's called hidden hunger, of people eating food that's of poor nutritional quality. But due to conflict, climate change, increasing problems with diseases and pests, agricultural production is fluctuating, is being unreliable. And as you will have seen across Europe as well, the numbers of family farmers are declining. We're seeing increasing movement of labourers, either urban areas or into migrant labour. And the stats that are presented in the Global Hunger Index are from 2019. So you can only imagine that with COVID-19, those numbers are actually going to be exacerbated with over an additional 100 million people facing hunger by the end of the year due to the impact not only of the disease itself, but of the public health containment measures.
Okay, and you mentioned some of the issues there, climate change, drought and conflict and displacement of people. They will be the main contributors, is that right?
They are. They're the most recent. Of course, for some of these countries, they're also lingering impacts of having been colonised, where infrastructure was set up to extract products, not necessarily to move things around a country, not necessarily to get produce across the region. Problems of local languages not being used in education. So the whole support and recognition of the importance of farming has not received the attention that it deserves.
And I want to focus just on education, knowledge transfer and enabling self-sufficiency among smaller food producers, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, I have to say that I, without naming them, I know that there are a lot of Irish agencies and charities and individuals and organisations that do work, you know, with poorer farmers in this in these countries. How important is education and enabling small farmers in these countries to be self-sufficient? Is that a strong tool against hunger?
Absolutely. The work that the Irish NGOs like Concern are doing are fundamental to be able to provide not only funds that enable schools to be rehabilitated, but also to work with people to adapt local curricula so that the curricula that for some people they won't get beyond primary school. So making sure that during that time in their in primary school, that they're getting the information that will help them to be successful farmers, working with approaches that are appropriate for their areas, and also have some knowledge about marketing and being successful farmers. And clearly the challenge of getting both boys and girls to school to be able to hear useful information.
We need to produce more food to feed a growing world population of possibly 9 billion by 2050. But that's from a dwindling arable land base. And we have to do it in an environmentally and animal welfare friendly manner, which protects, of course, the income of farm families, particularly in Ireland, for example, where we are a food producing nation. Is all of this possible? You know, is it possible to keep all these plates spinning at the same time?
If there's going to be a silver lining to the COVID-19 pandemic, it will be that we know that we can do things differently. This pandemic is forcing us to do that. And the way farming is done and the way farmers, the price signals going to farmers will need to change to allow farmers to be producing that good, nutritious food, to be rewarded for that product and to get the reward they need to farm in a sustainable manner while still feeding and clothing their families. On that, certainly for high-income countries like here in Australia, we have to be more efficient. Sorry, that's my potty lamb demanding food, if you can hear her there.
The irony is not lost on me that you've a hungry lamb there. I'm going to let you wait to feed, but that's fine.
Yeah, so we need to use what we produce more efficiently. Certainly, I know the Irish farmers are great. Here in Australia, in terms of animal-sourced food, when animals do go to market, there's a significant quantity of the carcass that's not going into the human food chain. So I think not only in improving production in low-income countries, controlling disease and pests, but also at home in income countries, doing our bit to be more efficient and supporting farmers who are doing the right thing, who want to do the right thing, and to get that policy framework. So I'm hoping listeners will, the Irish farmers and your farming associations will work with your government to get clear and practical advice through to the food summit that the United Nations will be holding at the end of next year. It's vitally important that farmers and people who know farming have a voice into this global summit.
Okay, and I know your report and details of it can be found on concern.net, www.concern.net. Will you ever go and feed that poor lamb there behind you, Robin? And thanks very much for chatting to us. And it's lovely to hear you. The line was breaking there, but we did get that message. And as you said, that summit is next year, and we got to all work towards that to try and reach a zero hunger situation by 2030. Lovely to chat to you. Do call by when you're here again.
Thanks so much, Damien.
Dr. Robin Anders there in New South Wales. Still to come on Countrywide. MEPs Grace O'Sullivan and Billy Kelleher talk cap reform, coping in lockdown, and moving to organic farming.
You're listening to Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Follow us on Twitter at RTE Countrywide.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Now, there's a big push going on across the EU to increase the amount of organic farming to about 1 in 4 farms of a national average across all countries by the year 2030. Now, that's not a big target in some countries like, we'll say, Estonia or Austria, but certainly it's a big target in Ireland, where there are currently less than 5% of farms in organics. Now, look, we've talked about organic farming here on the programme before, and we've decided to have a look now at it over the next few weeks, because there was recently in the budget more funding to help farmers convert from conventional to go into organics, or maybe even to start from scratch. So, Darren McCullough, good morning to you. Good to see
morning,
you again.
Morning, Damien.
You're going to be chatting over the next couple of weeks to different farmers who are at the early stages of it. And where did you begin?
Yeah, so this week I went down to meet a father and son, Tom and Alan Phelan, in Abbey Leaks in County Leash. Tom farms about 140 acres, 40 acres of which he describes as rough grazing. He was interested I thought it was interesting because, you know, he'd spent a lifetime as a conventional dry stock farmer in beef and sheep, and he decided to make two big jumps at the same time. He made the leap into dairying at the same time as making the leap into organics. Now, as he explained to me on the way out to see the new herd of cows, Tom always had an interest in dairying from the time that his dad used to milk cows. But there was also another key factor. He has a son, Alan, who, after being given the space to see a bit of the world, decided that, yes, he would like to have a go at farming.
We always flirted with the notion of dairying. Actually, since I got out of our small dairy herd 30 years ago, I never lost interest in dairying.
Yeah.
I always religiously read the dairy pages on the Farmer's Journal, the same as any other dairy farmer during the year. Maybe more so, because probably I had more time to read. But so I always stayed in touch with it.
Yeah.
But of course, then once the word was out that the dairy quotas were going, we certainly started to research the idea. We had no idea of organic at the time, but then Alan was quite young at the time as well, and I didn't know whether he was ready to commit to dairying.
Yeah.
So he.
And you're not an old fella yourself.
No, no, I'm not that. I'm 52, I suppose, yeah. So that's...
But
no,
maybe that's too old to be considering getting into dairying if you didn't have the next generation.
I wouldn't have dreamt of it, now, to tell you the dead honest truth. I wouldn't have dreamt of it if Alan wasn't interested. You know, while I was very interested myself and would have been disappointed not to have taken the opportunity, no, I wouldn't have taken on.
Come on, we go in and have a look at the cows.
Do indeed.
Just have a little walk around them. I mean, is the type of cow that you went for, the type of genetics you went for, any different from the type that you would have in a conventional herd?
Well, in organics, you don't have the option of having a very high yielding cow because you're only allowed to use 40% concentrates at any one time.
Yeah.
So
there's no point in going with a Holstein cow.
No, not a pure Holstein cow by any means. You don't have that option.
Yeah. So what I'm looking at here, I'm looking at browns and brownie blacks and whitey blacks, and there's a mixed bag.
There is, yeah. But they are a high EBI herd. Yeah. They came in conventional. These cows, while their milk is accepted as organic milk, they themselves would never be deemed organic. I did get a text lately saying that there was an outlet opening up for organic cow meat.
Yeah.
But these cows themselves will never be organic from a meat point of view, because they weren't born organic.
Yeah.
But the calves that have been born on this farm this year, they are organic and will always be organic.
Yeah.
And that's Tom there talking to me about his new herd of organic dairy cows. I think he really nailed the whole conversion process, Damien, because there's a 2-year conversion period where your output is not considered organic, but you have all these expensive organic feeds that you have to put into your livestock. But because he wasn't actually producing any milk during that period, in other words, he was waiting for these young calves to mature and calve down as cows, from the moment he put clusters on that new herd of cows during the late summer, every drop of milk that came out of them was organic. So he had that conversion top-up payment that kind of tided him over for that 2-year period. It's €220 per acre of a top-up for every acre when you're in the conversion period. After conversion, you still get a top-up of about €170 an acre, not to be sneezed at. And this is all part of how the EU is trying to encourage farmers to do more of this. He also isn't a real dyed-in-the-wool organics type. I suppose you can hear that. So his conversion to organics, I think, was totally practical. But he still touches on a point that I think I hear more and more farmers talking mm-hmm. about in relation to what got them thinking about organics in the first place.
We were never big users of spray. The same way as we were never big users of fertilizer, I was never 100% comfortable using sprays.
Yeah.
And I don't want to lecture other farmers go out and spray their fields, you know, but I was never quite comfortable either using it from my own point of view or using it on the soils.
Yeah. And maybe that was one of the things that left you open-minded, or at least open to the idea of going organic in the first place.
Of course, yes, of course it was. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was certainly, I always loved the idea of organic. I'd be telling a lie if I ever said if I said that I saw it as a commercial venture.
But if one of your cows gets sick now, what can you do for her?
Well, I suppose I did say it to you before. Some people may have the impression that if a cow gets sick, you have to stand looking at her as she pines away and dies. Yeah. But nothing could be further from the truth. Of course, what the vets say is final. If the vet deems she needs an antibiotic for her welfare, she has to get an antibiotic. You have to abide by longer withdrawals, but you can still use an antibiotic if it's necessary.
Because it sounds so irrational when, you know, you give us that explanation, but that is a genuine fear out there, isn't it?
It is. I'm sure. I mean, an awful lot of people said to me when I mentioned organics, they say that. They say, but you can't give them anything.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, practically, almost everything that's legal is available at an organic farm.
Yeah.
But you have to abide by longer withdrawal dates.
Like, when I came in there, I noticed a couple of bags of fertiliser in the yard, and I was thinking,
you did.
Jeepers, am I allowed to mention that?
No. Once again, chemical fertilisers are very restricted. That there is sulphate of potash, which if I get a dry spell in the next, potash can be spread during the close period. Yeah. And it was always recommended to spread potash in the autumn time, one way or the other.
So that's Tom there, being very open, you know, and that I had a lovely time down there with him, Damien. The other thing I should point out about that, I think it really suits Tom's situation and so many other farmers out there. You know, there's this idea that if you're converting to dairy and you have to go for a minimum of 100 cows and even bigger, whereas with organics, effectively 70 cows generates the same income as 100 cows. So for the dry stock farmer, it saves him having to put up new sheds, having to lease a heap of land in and get a heap of borrowings and put himself under a pile of pressure. Now, Tom's son, Alan, also managed to get a spake in when I was down there. Alan used to manage the very well-known Morrissey's pub in Abbey Leaks. So COVID has basically accelerated his transition from pulling pints to producing them. When we got back from the cows, Tom took me into their parlour where the conversation moved around to where the milk is going, which is Glenisk, and the price that they're getting, which is 60 cent a litre for the next 5 months, which is almost double what conventional milk is paying at the moment. But Tom is already thinking about the next angle for their organic milk, courtesy of Alan's girlfriend.
Al's girlfriend is a food scientist, and she has been in contact with the department with a view to possibly supplying raw milk.
Okay.
Which seems to be in huge demand.
Yeah.
For some unknown reason.
Okay.
But if
do you drink milk from the tank yourself?
Oh, I do indeed, of course. Yeah. Now, with a new herd, new equipment.
Yeah.
You know, so far the milk has been immaculate. Yeah. So, you know, I would give you a drink of it if you want.
Yeah.
You know, so we would be happy in that way.
Okay. What's the girlfriend's name?
Fiona.
Fiona. Yeah. We'd better give her a name.
Yeah.
And this could get serious quickly if, by the sounds of things.
Yeah. She's working in First Iron Spirits in the laboratory in Abilique.
Yeah.
They produce cream liqueurs and whiskies and all sorts. So she's always had an interest in producing her own product. So when she heard I had a dairy farm,
ready supply of...
that sounds bad.
Suddenly you were hot stuff, yeah.
But no, she's fiercely interested in it, and she's doing a lot of research, in, as Daddy said, in the whole raw milk side of it. So hopefully it'll come to something anyway.
Okay. Great. So there's a lot of opportunities kind of still out there in the future. You've already grasped some, but you're not at the end of the road yet.
Not by any means. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of the EU Farm to Fork strategy that was published last May, and it's been in the news quite a bit. Whether that's achievable or not, I can't see it achievable here in Ireland. If you've spent 30 years under a quota system, being held back all the time, with your production, and you know that you could produce more, and suddenly you've been let out of jail, so to speak, it's very difficult to entertain the notion that maybe if you produce a little bit less, you could be as far on.
Well, they sound happy anyway. That's Tom Phelan there and his son Alan. And Dara, I know you'll be heading off to find out about another farmer who's getting into organics on the programme next week. But will you stay with me, Dara McCullough, because I know you'll have an interest in our next item, because the Common Agricultural Policy accounts for one third of EU spending, and it's worth around €1.5 billion to Irish food producers annually in the form of supports. And every 7 years it's reviewed and it's tweaked and it's reformed. And that's what's been happening right now. And this week was a big week in reforming the policy, with the Parliament voting on amendments. And now it goes to the final stage before implementation. However, there's a lot of anger among environmentalists at what was voted for by MEPs in Brussels this week. Now, the policy is very detailed and complex and detailed, but in summary, regarding environmental measures, it's proposing, these are the headline figures, 30% of farm payments will be dedicated to eco-schemes covering an environment, climate and animal welfare measures, but it's voluntary for farmers. They can either just pick up the 70% and not bother about the other 30% if they don't want to do anything. I'm sure a lot of them would like the other 30%. One third of rural development funding is ring-fenced for environmental schemes, while farmers must put at least 5% of their arable land aside for biodiversity. That's mandatory, but it can rise to 10% if incentivised by member states. Now, environmentalists have reacted furiously, describing the proposed policy as greenwashing at its finest and an end to the EU's ambitious Green Deal. Joining me now are two MEPs who were part of the voting process this week, Grace O'Sullivan of the Green Party and Fianna Fáil's Billy Kelleher. You're both very welcome to the programme. Grace, I'll begin with you. You were among the minority who voted against the policy as it was put through, but with possibly the biggest focus ever on environment in the history of CAP. Why?
Good morning, Damien. I suppose, really, it was very clear to us that what was being done here was what we'd call greenwashing, that the terms like eco-schemes, different systems, that when you really looked at them carefully, that they were actually quite hollowed out, and that there was a lot of positive language being used, but when you dug down into it, that we weren't going to get the results. And the biggest issue for us was the fact that the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, had come forward a few months ago with the European Green Deal, with the Farm to Fork strategy, the biodiversity strategy, all because MEPs last year voted to recognise that there was a biodiversity and climate crisis. And so we want an alignment of this cap that's on the table now with those policies. And what we saw this week was actually there wasn't alignment, that parties like the EPP and Renew, which Billy is part of, actually voted against aligning the policy.
I know there's
so
a bit of a delay.
In the wrong direction.
Yeah, a bit of a delay there. But Grace, what are you looking for? I mean, as I said, €30 in every 100 that a farmer or food producer is going to receive has to be compliant with environmental actions on their farm.
Yeah, but we want to acknowledge that the action is it's worthwhile to the areas to develop the sustainable farming, so that the money that 30% or whatever that family farms and like progressive family farms like you just had Tom on there, that they will be really supported. This budget that's there at the moment is actually supporting a much larger intensive agricultural production. It's still going to push money, funnel money into pesticide use, fertilizer use. We have a problem with water quality in Ireland. We don't see that the actual objectives within the policy will be met by what is being proposed. Like I said, there's so many loopholes. The minister, commissioner said, he said it was this week. He said the deal struck by the three groups of which Billy's part of is a backward step for the for farming and for the environment.
Okay, and on that, Billy, and you're listening to Grace there. There's been uproar, as I said, among the environmental lobbying, including Greenpeace, Greta Thunberg, BirdLife Europe, Friends of the Earth, the Worldwide Fund, and many, many more who are dedicated to climate action. Haven't you just torn up Ursula von der Leyen's Green Deal project and bowed to intensive agriculture by voting this through this week? Listening to Grace there.
Well, if you were to believe everything that was said about the Common Agricultural Policy, its aims, its objectives, and what was being discussed this week and what was voted on. I mean, this was a reform of the Common Agricultural Policy. This has been planned for over 2 years. It was planned in advance of the Green Deal ever being announced, in fact. But in this particular Common Agricultural Policy, there is clear objectives in terms of funding going to eco-schemes and going to biodiversity schemes and going to ensure that we enhance our environment. And if you underpin the Common Agricultural Policy with the Green Deal, with the Farm to Fork and the biodiversity strategy, I would be very confident. I wish there was more in it as well, Damien. But, you know, I mean, we live in a parliament that I don't have a majority in, and neither does Grace. So we have to compromise on certain issues. But I think at the end of the day, the overall impact of the decisions we make, the trilogue discussions that will go on over the next number of weeks and months between the Council, the Commission and the Parliament, will ensure that we have a common agricultural policy, which first and stays objectives, Damien, is to ensure that we have a security supply of food, that we have a vibrant farming and agricultural sector and a rural environmental sector, and those particular objectives must be met first. On top of that, then, we have the biodiversity strategy, we have the farm to fork strategy, and they will put clear obligations on farming throughout the European Union to reduce pesticide use, to reduce fertiliser use, and to ensure that greenhouse gas emissions are reduced in accordance with the overall strategy.
Billy, with all due respect, the NGOs who are at the coalface of this have absolutely rubbished it and said it's the end of the Green Deal. It is greenwashing at its finest. They know what they're talking about, don't they?
I've NGOs who have contacted me too, saying the exact opposite, that this is a progressive step in the right direction, bearing in mind in the stated objectives, we're talking about enhancing and increasing organic farming across the European Union, arable land set aside for biodiversity up to 10%. You know, these are significant changes. And then on top of what's mentioned in this particular CAP reform, the Green Deal itself, the Farm to Fork strategy, the biodiversity strategy, and this particular CAP puts money behind the environment. It shores it up, it underpins it, and it makes it core. So there will be added incentives to farming and the agricultural sector in general to move towards environmentally friendly, compatible farming, both in terms of production and downstream from that.
Okay, Grace, I have quoted, as I said, the many environmental lobby groups there, but to quote one farm lobby group, COPA, this is the umbrella body for EU farm lobbyists across the member states. and I'm paraphrasing here, they said there's an incredible amount of misinformation on social media and in the press against the farming community by activists who've never experienced the reality of farming on the ground, and that farmers are constantly increasing their efforts but not getting recognised for. Now, is there, Grace, a lot of misinformation being, as they say, quote, deliberately being put around to undermine the millions of farmers across Europe?
Well, I suppose the first point is that they are actually quite a large farming lobby that support intensification of agriculture using pesticides and chemicals, you know. So I would say that, to reply to Billy, I've been receiving quite a lot of contact also from progressive farmers who actually recognise that they want to produce the foods, they want to produce the healthy food in a sustainable way, and they want to sustain their farms as well. And the problem is that we have a conflict between the large industrial agriculture sector, of which Ireland's in a slightly different position to some of the other European membership countries. Mm-hmm. So there is difference, but I truly believe that that what we see at the moment, and as I said, which has been the Agriculture Commissioner has agreed, it's a backward step. Now, the positive thing for us is that the game isn't over, it's not a game, it's the livelihoods and the monies the cap isn't over, that the discussions are still going to continue, it's going to go into trilogue now. But I just want to say just one more...
Briefly, Grace, because we're out of time, and I want to give Billy a quick response.
Yeah, but Billy, you voted against Alliance with the Green Deal and the biodiversity strategy and the Farm to Fork strategy.
Okay.
You voted against that, and that's not correct.
Okay, Billy, quick response. Not correct.
Well, look, I mean, I don't know what Parliament Grace was sitting in this week, but I mean, I voted on numerous amendments that were very, very environmentally friendly and supported many amendments from the Greens and from other groupings as well. The fact of the matter is, Grace, I don't have a monopoly in the Parliament and neither do you. And I certainly wouldn't have voted for anything that I believe would have jeopardised my family's future, my neighbours' futures and my country's future.
Okay.
But I'm very confident that with this particular cap, it will underpin farm incomes, it will allow for them to farm, it will also allow them to adapt to the new policy that will be enshrined in the Farm to Fork and the biodiversity.
Right.
And CAP is to underpin that. It is not an end in itself.
Okay, and this is a subject we will be coming back to. Darragh McCullough, 40 seconds just to summarise what you're hearing there. Where are we now?
We're on a journey. And what you can see, what you listen to there is, you know, the various negotiating teams and camps, still staking out their position. And they're still in the teeth of a negotiation process. Greening of CAP payments started, nearly 10 years ago. There's basically, I have to plant, because I have more than 25 acres in arable, I have to have more than two or three crops. I have to have a rotation. That was just the start of it. And this is a process that's going to continue. I'm delighted to see, for example, the accusations by the environmentalists that this is tokenistic. I mean, multi-species sward, for example, we have it at home on our own farm. We don't get any payment for it. It's a brilliant way of reducing fertilizer usage. And now farmers are going to be encouraged and paid to do it.
Well,
it's got to be progress.
All right. OK, thank you very much to you, Darragh. Grace O'Sullivan, thank you. And to Billy Kelleher, thank you both indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. As I said, it is not over. The future of CAP, we will come back to this in the coming weeks. Well, finally this morning, it has been a difficult week for everybody with level 5 restrictions coming into force again. Writer and farmer John Connell took some time to reflect on the news and offer some words of hope.
The times are changing. The rain has come and the short days are here. Now is the time of the inner harvest, as we prepare ourselves to hold fast against the storms that will blow against this land, this people, this time. In working the land these last few weeks, I have found joy in old things. The tending of ewes' feet, the bedding down of cows, the sight of the first new life on the farm. I say old things, for they are the rhythm of life in this rural world. But in the joy of old things I have found new ways to embrace them all, for there is a gaiety in it that was not there before. A wonder that shows that nature goes on, continues on, though our human world has stopped in ways. We have been to this place before. We held fast in the first wave and found new ways of being, from the baking of bread to the watching of mass through our phones. We pulled together and discovered a world on our doorstep that was all the world we ever needed. From the flower-strewn ditches to distance conversations across a wall. It was not all joy, and not all of us made it through, but we have promised to remember our dead in the time to come, in the place beyond the virus, where hugs and handshakes welcome us. We are not in that land yet. We are only now taking up the Camino to make it through this winter time of the soul. There is a hope, a promise from afar, from the family of man, that this virus will end, that we will find a cure. But for now, for us farming people, our jobs are clear. We must bring new life into the world. We must feed our fellow man. We must endure, for the world needs us now more than ever. And though our farms have become outposts of sorts, we must know too that we are not alone. The mart days will come again, the summer fairs, the livestock shows. We will meet our neighbours and celebrate in our old ways, a pint, a chat, a hug, and the talk. The talk that keeps us going will come again. I will take joy in the farm this season. I will value this farming life in a way I have not done for a time, for we are lucky. We have work, we have purpose, and at a time of decay, we are in the business of creation. I think now, too, we are done with our voyages around the world. We are taking up voyages of the heart, and in that there is a chance of learning like never before. It is in that land that I will see you in the springtime meadows where all is new again. Stay safe, stay rooted, stay true to the earth.
Yeah, the thoughts there of John Connell and John's new book out, The Running Book, fabulous read. And thanks to John for that. Now, that's all we have time for this week. Thanks to the team of Eileen, Brian and Mark outside the glass here. Don't forget, Dara and the gang will be back with Ear to the Ground on RT1 television on Thursday at 8:30. Stay tuned for playback after the 9 News here on Radio 1. Until I talk to you at the same time next week. Bye-bye and thanks for listening.